This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The power of editorial cartoons and the view from Germany. It's our weekly review of the news, starting with a proposal released on Wednesday by Governor Matt Bevin and state GOP leaders that will make some big changes to Kentucky's troubled pension system for state employees. Joining me now is Daniel DeRocher, political writer for the Lexington Herald-Leader. Good afternoon, Daniel.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Daniel, give us an overview of this this latest plan that's been released for fixing the pension system in Kentucky.
So basically it'll change things. I mean, it brings changes to the pension system, probably the biggest being that all future hires for state and local employees and for teachers, they'll be put into a 401k style plan. So that's the biggest thing. In terms of current employees in the system, depending on how many years you've served, so for state and local workers, if you were hired after 2014, they'll roll you right over into a 401k style plan in July when this thing eventually goes into effect, should they pass it in the special legislative session. And all current employees in the teacher system and in the state and local employee system, when they hit 27 years of service or they hit the retirement age, they can continue to keep working, but they'll put all their benefits will go into a 401k style plan instead of being added to their pension. And that's a pretty big change. There's a 5-year buffer period, I think it's a 3 or 5 year buffer period for teachers, but state employees don't have the same kind of buffer. But really, the big difference is instead of a pension system, over time, Kentucky is going to be transitioning into a 401k style system for all of the government employees, except for hazardous employees, people who do hard labor.
So police and firefighters and hard labor?
So state police, and basically, yeah, hard labor. But there is a distinction here, right? So a lot of police officers, it's handled at the local level for like city and county police officers. So while 53% of police forces are in the hazardous plan, the one that doesn't change very much and doesn't move people over to a 401k, there's still 47% of police departments that would be switched over into this type of a 401k plan should they exceed their or should they get to their maximum level of service.
So it's the difference between right now they have a defined benefit plan being the pension. They can expect to get so much out when they retire. A set amount that's defined versus a defined contribution plan where you're going to be contributing the money yourself into your retirement plan. And I suppose that it'll work the same. The state will contribute part two as well.
Yeah, the state contributes a match or a portion to what the different employees contribute. So like, for example, teachers don't get Social Security in Kentucky. And so their maximum is going to be 18%, and 12% of that will come from the teachers. The teachers can max out at 12%, and then 6% of that will come from the employer match, which is 4% from the state and 2% from local school boards.
513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk to Tom. Hi, Tom.
I think you just answered part of my question. Thanks for taking my question. But you mentioned that the teachers have Social Security coverage, or they don't. I'm sorry. I take it none of the state employees probably pay into anything other than the Medicare contribution. So really, you know, what you're saying is that the state is still looking at matching at 6% over the 12% Social Security. I just think there's always a lot of confusion with public pensions. A lot of people don't understand that the employers, state, county, whatever, aren't paying into Social Security, and there's times when their contributions to state pensions are less than what every small business has to pay for their employees into Social Security. So go ahead, and if you could just expand on what you just said to the teachers, I'd be interested in knowing what kind of a foundation the state employees will have if they don't have Social Security and they don't have a defined benefit plan.
So So from what I understand, the state employees and local employees, I mean, I may be incorrect here, but I do think that they can collect Social Security, whereas the teachers cannot.
Teachers cannot. Yeah, that's my understanding too, Daniel.
And so there will be a state match, and I think he was right. It's going to be around 6% for current state and local employees. But in the detailed plan that they released, they included the exact numbers for teachers. They did not include the exact numbers for the state and local employees. So I do not have that in front of me. So
and that 6% match, Daniel, is actually for the 401k plan, right?
Yeah, it would be for the 401k plan.
The employee can put in up to 12%, and then the state would match another 6%.
So for teachers,
yes.
It's going to be lower for state and local employees, but for teachers, it is 12%. Then the state has so then the employer, right? That's so 4% comes from the state and 2% comes from the local government or local school board, that sort of thing. Which is actually something that school boards are kind of. They're looking into because they're going to have to pay a little bit more if this thing goes through because they currently don't have to match that 2%.
What's the cutoff date? In other words, where would they consider you to be a new or newer employee that would go into the 401k plan, and what would they consider to be an employee that can stay in the pension system?
So the cutoff is going to be June 30th, 2018, or so July 1st, 2018. So anybody hired after July 1st, 2018, they're going to be into a 401k plan. And then, so there's different nuances for this, right? So teachers who have been working and university employees that have been working for fewer than 5 years, they're also going to have the option to move into a defined contribution plan rather than staying in the pension plan. And then, like I said, for the state and local employees, because of the changes that were made in 2013, anybody hired after 2014 is not protected by the same contract that other state and local employees are protected by. And so those people will be moved into the 401k July 1st, 2018, just like all the new hires.
So, Daniel, what about the idea that does this encourage anyone who's at retirement age now to bail out in order to get the most pension money?
The governor's office is saying no, there should be no reason for people to bail out. But we are already seeing an uptick in people who are going at least and getting retirement counseling. And we've seen an uptick in numbers of people who have said that they want to retire in the state government. I mean, it really depends on what people feel. So part of the thing that they're doing, especially for teachers, they were concerned about this with a bunch of teachers retiring in July, if the 27-year cap went into effect right away, because there are, I think it's something like there's a large number of teachers who are eligible for retirement right now, and so they put a 5-year buffer on that for teachers. Let me make sure it was 5 years. They put a 3-year buffer on that for teachers. So teachers can continue if they hit their 27-year their 27 years, or if they're eligible, if they've met the threshold of 27 years on July 1st, 2018, they will have an additional 3 years where they can get money into their defined benefit plan before they're moved into a 401k plan. And that, in effect, is an attempt in some ways to prevent that kind of exodus of teachers that so many are concerned about.
Does the plan address that? I know the problem that the pension systems in Kentucky are facing is that there's tens of billions of dollars in unfunded pension liabilities that already exist. Does this plan do anything to address the pension liabilities?
It does. Some to address it. How much, we're not sure. We're waiting on actuarial analysis from a bunch of groups to know how much money it might save. Probably the biggest thing that saves money is one of the few things that affects current retirees, and that affects current teachers who are retired. And basically, it's going to freeze the cost of living adjustment for current retired teachers for 5 years. And right now, teachers get a 1.5 cost of living adjustment each year. And so by freezing that, they will save a lot of money for the state. But part of this, too, is that this thing's probably going to be challenged in court. Pretty much everybody expects that somebody will file some kind of suit. And that'll, I mean, we'll see what'll happen with that. I mean, the governor's office is pretty confident that this thing is not go, that it doesn't violate the contract between workers and the government. But it's going to be challenged, and it's going to be settled by the courts in all likeliness.
Well, what's been some of the other reaction to this from employees, from city leaders?
Yeah, I mean, people are waiting to read the actual bill, right? So all we have is a framework. We don't know all the details yet. We just know basically what they're trying to do. And so people are kind of reserving judgment until they see that. But there's a lot of concern among the various advocacy groups that, again, this thing might, or runs the potential of violating the contract. And the biggest ones there are, like I said, the freezing of the cost of living adjustments for current retired teachers. The cap, the 27-year cap, there's a concern that that might be violating the inviolable contract. Because it sets a limit to how much people can get in their defined benefit plan that already exists. There's changes to sick days, so this goes into effect on July 1st, 2023, but after that date, teachers won't be able to use their sick leave to do benefit calculations. So right now, teachers can get a little bit extra when they retire, if they have a bunch of unused sick days, and that won't be a thing anymore. It'll also affect sick day calculations for current employees, both hazardous and non-hazardous. They won't be able to use their unused sick days to determine their eligibility for retirement. So that'll make changes there. And so all of those issues are kind of, I wouldn't say they're sticking points, but the things that have kind of raised the awareness of the different groups, and they're going to probably try to resist those changes. Whether or not that'll actually be effective, whether or not they'll actually be able to accomplish anything with that is really up for debate.
You know, there's been a call for the county employees' retirement system to be allowed to split off from the state system. Does this new plan address that particular issue?
So the new plan does not have that in the current, so that is not in the plan, right? Now the League of Cities is still kind of they're still optimistic that they might be able to get it into the final bill. Whether or not that'll happen, I don't know, because Governor Bevin, during the press conference, said he thinks that it would be ridiculous that with this plan, he thinks that it's really addressing the pension crisis as is, and any group that wanted to pull out from the solutions that he's proposed, he thinks would be I think he may have used the word silly. I don't know if he likes that word, but he thinks that it would be inadvisable to want to pull out and want to separate from the system after the changes that he proposed go through.
Yeah, Kentucky's not alone in its pension problems. Do you know if this type of proposal has been tried in any other states?
We would actually be one of the few states to actually switch over to a mandatory 401k style plan for most of the groups, right? So right now, there's only three states that have mandatory 401k plans, Alaska, Oklahoma, and Michigan, and there's certain groups. So I think in Arizona, teachers might have a mandatory 401k plan, but in general, not a lot of people have switched over to this. And the Bevin administration kind of thinks that it will be paving the way. It'll be creating the future, or because other states have this problem, they'll be creating a path where states can make changes to these pension benefits to kind of fix their liabilities.
Does the legislature have to take any action on this, Daniel?
Yes. So Governor Bevin will eventually have to call a special, well, he doesn't have to call a special session, but he said that he will call a special session to do this, and that'll be around 5 days, and they'll have to pass a bill that has all of this stuff. And that's, again, that's what we're waiting on now, is we want to see this bill. I think the governor said it's something like 400 pages, but the actual content that's being changed is smaller and more straightforward. And so that'll go through the whole legislative process where it'll get its hearings and it'll get a floor vote and both the House and the Senate, and then the governor will have to sign it into effect.
But is this for sure going to happen?
So the press conference had Speaker Hoover, it had Senate President Stivers, and it had Governor Bevin. That's usually a pretty good indication that this thing will pass, because they were the people in control in each body of the legislature. Now there's question over whether or not it has enough votes, whether or not people will hold out. But from speaking to representatives and speaking to senators, it sounds like this thing probably will have enough votes. Again, it depends on how much resistance that teachers or different groups put up against this thing. But it sounds like it has a pretty good chance that it'll pass.
And we got a question from Sally. What does this mean for former state employees They're not retired, but they hope to collect a Kentucky pension eventually. I guess she's in a situation where she worked for the state at one point. Now she's working for somebody else.
So it really doesn't do much for current retirees, right? There were different proposals that were made in the outside analysis, and they didn't accept that. So nothing really changes for current retirees except for those teacher retirees who get the five-year freeze on their cost of living adjustment. There is a change for people who say they worked for the state for 14 years, and then they left to go work for a private company that was not in the public. If they say they went to go leave and work in the private sector, so they will all their pension benefits will be suspended while they work in the private sector, and then if they choose to come back, they can start up on their pension again, or they can come back as a new employee and collect it as a 401k.
So if I understand you correctly, they're shooting for July 2018 is when this would all start?
Yeah, so that's when it would go into effect. So the Frankfurt talk is basically there's no emergency clause on this thing. An emergency clause means that it goes into effect right when it's signed. They're not doing that for this. So it would have to wait a certain amount of time, and that would put it at July 1st, 2018, when it would go into effect.
Daniel, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Daniel DeRocher, political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader. Coming up, The View from Germany. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. 91.7 is looking forward to welcoming Ken Rudin, the political junkie, back to Cincinnati next week. On Thursday morning, you can stop by the Coffee Emporium and Over the Rhine to meet Ken, me, and other members of the WVXU news team between 8 and 9. Then Ken and Howard Wilkinson will be with me at 1 o'clock in the afternoon for our monthly political junkie show. Joining me now is Ben Vink, a reporter for DPA in Germany, who's currently visiting Cincinnati. And good afternoon, Ben.
Hello.
Thank you for being here. If you'd like to join us, 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ben, first, if you could tell us about your trip to Cincinnati, your visit here, and the purpose of that, why you're here, and what you're looking at.
I'm on an exchange program that's for German media journalists, and they exchange with American journalists who come over to Berlin and see Brussels and other cities in Germany and Belgium. And I'm here for 3 weeks. My first week was in Washington, D.C. We went to think tanks there and visited other media, like we went to Telemundo, for example. And then our third week is in New York City, where we will do the same, basically, what we did in Washington. And we're a group of 12 people. And for the second week, we all went to different stations all over the U.S. Like, I have colleagues who are in Las Vegas or Charlottesville or Gainesville. I'm in Cincinnati. Ann Thompson went to Germany for the program on this side. And now I'm with her and looked how your media works.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does DPA stand for?
The DPA is Deutsche Presseagentur, which translates into German press agency.
So, see, I'm glad you said that instead of me trying to say it.
Yeah. And it's a news agency that is owned by basically all the media in Germany. And all the media in Germany basically is its customers. So we send out wire texts, bigger articles to them, and they can use it however they want. And they also have a radio department and a video department and, like, a lot of departments.
Yeah, sounds a little bit like it's similar to the Associated Press that we have here in the United States, where the members basically drive everything. They contribute stories, and they have a staff at AP that also writes stories that the members can use.
Mm-hmm.
So what type of stories does DPA cover?
It's basically everything. It's politics, it's crime, it's sports, it's economy, business, all the stories, basically.
Okay. Again, so much similar to what we have here in the United States as far as how your media covers things. How exactly does it operate? You have a staff of reporters at DPA
Like, we have a big newsroom in Berlin, which is the central heart of DPA. And we have in every basically in every state, not in all states, the smaller states don't have that, but in every state we have what's called a Landesbüro, which is a state office, kind of, where there's reporters, and we have reporters in Berlin, and they contribute. Also, we have staff writers and editors and producers, and yeah.
Do you have what we call beat reporters, where you cover a specific area, government or business or crime or police or courts, that type thing?
Yeah, we would have that. For example, we have what's called federal reporters. You would translate that like Bundeskorrespondenten, the federal correspondents, and they're like really deep into politics. They report about the main parties. They have special topics they report about, so they go really deep into that. But most of us, we're kind of generalists. Like we have to basically cover a lot. For example, I work at the radio department, and we don't have enough people to be specialized into different topics. So I have to do politics, I have to do economy, I really like to report on tech and tech news, so that's kind of my thing.
Something you and Ann Thompson have in common there.
Yeah.
You're both technology reporters.
Yeah.
What are the top stories in Germany? What are
right now?
Yeah.
Right now, it's all after the election. We had a big election a few weeks back for our parliament. And now, how do I explain this? The political system in Germany is a bit different from what you have in the U.S. We don't have two parties. We have now six parties.
Yeah, the term, I think, is it's a federal republic. Is that the...
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. We have six parties in the parliament now, so it gets kind of crowded. And what Angela Merkel, she basically won the big election. And we don't vote for a chancellor or a president. We vote for parties. And then the biggest party gets They are the ones who try to find other parties they want to work with together, and then they have to build a contract on which they work the whole legislature of 4 years together.
And the biggest party is where your chancellor comes from as
exactly,
well.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. That's the CDU or Union. It's kind of like a middle to right conservative party. And the big issue about these past votes were that the AfD, which is a really right-wing party, they got 13%, which is fairly high for us. So we have a right-wing party that is, they're not Nazis, but there are voices in there that are kind of apologetic to the Third Reich. And they say, yeah, we don't want to, like, this is history, this is the past. We don't want to talk about that much. And they're really concerning views in there, in that party. It's a fairly new party. So that is really a concerning thing. And now Angela Merkel is trying to get a coalition started, which is kind of hard because she has to work together with her own party, the Greens and the Liberals, and getting them together is kind of hard because they have different views on everything. And yeah,
she's got her work cut out for her, in other words.
Oh yeah, yeah. And like the last coalition talks which were going on after the past elections, they were fairly easy, and now we're looking to having a new government by December, end of December, which is really long.
Now, what do Germans and the German media think about our First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, compared to what you have in Germany?
That's a tough one. We have freedom of press, we have freedom of speech, but it's a bit more restricted in Germany because there is this thing called hate speech, which is not allowed in Germany. So there are certain parts which has to do with our past, which has to do with the Third Reich, that are not allowed to. Well, you can say a lot, but you can't. For example, you can't show a swastika or a swastika flag. You're not allowed to show that on your clothing or a flag or something. That's not allowed. So there are certain types of things that would get you in legal trouble.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much do German news organizations, people in Germany, follow what's going on in the U.S.?
A lot.
especially nowadays, I would
imagine. Especially nowadays,
yeah.
There's a thing that I would say, it's from me. That's not how we talk in the DPA, but...
this is your personal opinion coming out of you?
All of this is my personal opinion. I can't speak for DPA. But I say it's the Daily Trump, where he says something and then it's in the media the day afterwards. It has to do with the U.S. being a big, important partner for us. Like, there's really close connections, especially here in Cincinnati, where there's a big German heritage. But the U.S. is a really important partner for us. And the other thing is that what I think... the morning news are getting more and more important. Like, the first thing you do in the morning, you just look at your cell phone and see what's going on in the world. And what's happening at night for us is news in the U.S. So there's not a lot going on in Germany at night. So we take what's going on in the U.S. and put that on our sites.
Now, do you keep track of like the natural disasters that we have in this country, like the recent hurricanes and the fires in California? Did those receive a lot of attention too?
I would say Puerto Rico was a big, big story, and the hurricanes who were going on there and in Florida and Texas, they were big stories. The wildfires... not that much. It's a big story, but not as big as the hurricanes.
So I'll ask you for one more opinion. Is this your first time in Cincinnati, first off?
This is my first time in
what
Cincinnati.
What do you think?
I like it. I'm a bit puzzled about Cincinnati because, like, there's a trend towards the downtown coming up again.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really unthinkable in Germany, where downtown is where the thing happens. It's like in the big cities in the U.S., I guess, like New York. Downtown is the cool place where the cool people live, and it's really expensive. So I was a bit puzzled about that there's a lot of closed stores downtown and, in Cincinnati.
So quite a contrast to what you're used to seeing.
Yeah,
but as you say, the downtown area is starting to come back, and mm-hmm. Cincinnati has made a strong comeback in recent years. And a lot of urban areas and a lot mm-hmm. of downtown areas in this country are starting to be rejuvenated. So,
And I went to Findlay Market, which was nice, and I looked around town. I went around downtown. I drove along the Ohio River, which was really nice yesterday. So
Daniel,
really pretty here.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Or I should say Ben. Ben Vink is a reporter for DPA in Germany, who's currently visiting Cincinnati. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Benjamin Franklin gets the credit for publishing America's first political cartoon in his Pennsylvania Gazette newspaper back in 1754. It was a call for the colonies to unite against British rule. Editorial cartoons 263 years later continue to be a force for commenting on and influencing key issues. And joining me now, Cincinnati Business Courier editorial cartoonist and audience development director Joe Hoffecker, and illustrator and editorial cartoonist at WCPO.com, Kevin Necessary. You can join the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Joe, good to see you this afternoon. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And Kevin, thank you for being here. Much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'd like to find out from each of you, when did you first realize that you wanted to become an editorial cartoonist? And Kevin, go ahead and start us off.
I guess when I realized when I wasn't a good enough artist to do anything else.
really?
Okay. But growing up in Cincinnati, and I'm sure Joe's going to, echo this, we were blessed to have Jim Borgman as our local editorial cartoonist. And, seeing his cartoons in the paper day after day after day, really influenced me on, this is something that I wanted to do. Something about his artwork just spoke to me. And that's kind of the path that I followed.
Yeah.
I was there when Ben Franklin published that. So
were you,
that was my
1754. That Ben was your hero. He said, "I need to do editorial cartoons like that."
That's exactly it. What Kevin said. Jim Borgman was a big influence, but as an early child, my earliest memories are doodling and drawing. As I got older, my parents were very. The dinner table was always talk about current events. And, I learned about the Vietnam War and Watergate from them through their conversations. And sometimes they didn't always agree, which was kind of cool to see that debate. So I remember my mom showing me what probably was one of Jim's first cartoons at the Enquirer. And I thought, oh, my God, this is a work of art. This guy not only knows how to draw really well, but he's, stating an opinion on current events. And so blending of those two things was just fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did you get your start?
Well, I started, I went to Elder High School on the West Side, and the student paper there, you were only allowed to submit anything or work for it when you were a junior or senior. But as a sophomore, I kept drawing cartoons and submitting them and finally wore them down. So, yeah.
And Kevin, what about you? How did you actually get your start in this?
I was in the last graduating class of Lakota High School, the original Lakota, before it split. And I was in their journalism program. They needed someone who was an editorial cartoonist, and I kind of signed up on a whim. And when I discovered that my cartoons, could actually say something and could have an effect on not just maybe the student body, but even the administration, that just really cemented it for me.
So did you actually do a cartoon that affected the administration at school? Did that actually happen?
Actually, at the time in between, I'd say like 1995 and 1997, which is when I graduated, there was a lot of controversy about banned books, like I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings and other books like that. And I found that my cartoons. We're perfect about bringing the sort of a student voice into that conversation, where a lot of that conversation was being done between parents and the school board and teachers, I would see my cartoon just kind of floating around at different times. So it was great.
You knew you were getting through to somebody.
Yeah.
Well, I think the key to that is they could have written an editorial about it. Or stories about it, but I think that a picture says a thousand words,
yeah,
and it
yeah.
resonates with people so immediately. And depending on how it's drawn or the subject matter, it could carry through. So folks are copying it and posting it, and so that's very effective.
And taking credit for it, and
that's when you know you really did something good, right?
Right.
And then there's the other side, that people that don't like what you say. So,
right.
Yeah.
Now, Joe, what about you're celebrating 30 years? In cartooning,
mm-hmm.
What has changed? Are you freer now to express themes that maybe you couldn't have expressed 30 years ago?
For sure. Our audience is a business audience, a local business audience. So for a good period of my tenure at the Courier, I was always reminded and steered back to that. So, the subject matter has to be something that our audience can relate to. But in recent years, they've really freed that up. In fact, to a point where I just basically discuss with my editor what I'd like to draw for each week instead of sketching it out and having multiple ideas. So so that's been nice. The other big change, obviously, is technology.
Kevin, what kind of traits make for a good editorial cartoonist?
I think just being informed is probably the biggest part. I would say, and I told my editors this when I first started, that I would be spending most of my day reading news. That's that to me is 90% of my job, and having an opinion, not just going out and blurting out whatever you feel like saying, but actually having an informed opinion. I went to journalism school so that I could learn to become a reporter and an editor. So that I knew what to draw and why I was drawing something. So I think that's probably the biggest thing. But the other thing is clarity. You really have to be clear. And that's one of the things that I love about Joe's cartoons that I haven't gotten to professionally, which is I think I tend to put too much into a cartoon, whereas Joe's cartoons are wonderfully just clear and to the point. And it's, you know, it's a place where I hope I can get to in my career.
You know, it's funny that you say that, and I appreciate the compliments, but I admire his ability to tell stories in a concise, well-drawn way. So it's kind of funny that we have that. I think my cartoons are the way that Kevin described, because I'm lazy. It's just easier to draw simple.
So, Joe, what traits do you think? Kevin just mentioned what he thinks is important. What do you think is important?
Well, I think just kind of an inherent sense of humor, and Kevin certainly has that. You know, we banter back and forth, and finding humor in almost anything is important.
You know, Kev, it's kind of interesting, Kevin. It's a unique situation that you're in, because how many times do you see a TV media organization that has an editorial cartoonist? I think that's a rather unique thing.
Yeah, I only know of one other station, which is down in North Carolina, that modeled itself after what we were doing here. But you know, we're in this age of media where we're not thinking of ourselves as just a TV station. You know, we're a multimedia, you know, news platform. So, you know, we have digital, we have TV, we have podcasts. So, you know, and we're obviously on social media. So, it's kind of a holistic news organization.
I'm talking with Cincinnati Business Courier editorial cartoonist and audience development director Joe Hoffecker, and illustrator and editorial cartoonist at WCPO.com, Kevin Necessary. And if you'd like to join us, any questions or comments, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So what's the process like? How do you go about deciding and creating an editorial cartoon?
You know, I think it's every waking hour, and sometimes when you're sleeping. You know, like Kevin, paying attention to what's going on in the news is important. And then just trying to, you know, for me, just narrow down to a couple topics of what I think would be relevant by the time, you know, readers are going to see the cartoons. And then I think the process is just kind of like, okay, well, what do I want to say about this? What's my opinion? And what's kind of the, you know, is there humor that could be invoked into it as well?
Yeah, it's I heard it described as the Evel Knievel process, which is where you get from one ramp, and you're just ramping up, and then somehow you land on the other side,
and you launch yourself in the middle and hope for the best.
Pretty much.
There have been moments when you've done this, where you wake up in the middle of the night and it's like, oh my God, there's an idea.
Yeah.
Or you'll be will have completed a cartoon, and you think of another idea on the topic that's better.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and you're you know, sometimes you just have to go with what you have. Sometimes you have enough time to scramble and get it done. And then there are those days, you know, that happen, you know, more often than not, where it's late in the afternoon and I have nothing. I have been sitting around reading the news, doing these little tiny sketches on scraps of newsprint or on post-it notes, and nothing is clicking. And at that point, you know, you just have to go with whatever you have, and hope that, you know, that at least it's okay. Because, you know, there's going to be another cartoon, and you just move on to the next.
So you guys get writer's block, or I guess cartoonist block now and then?
Oh, yeah.
For sure, yeah. I think one of the things, you know, what we do is we're kind of in a conscious, unconscious state. So when everybody dreams, they dream about reality, but it's stretched and exaggerated. Well, that's what we do. So it's trying to put yourself into that state. And it's just the worst thing for me is seeing a blank piece of paper staring back at you.
Yeah,
I can imagine. And a deadline coming up, like Kevin was saying.
Yeah.
How tough is it to condense an entire theme and idea into a single panel?
Oh, it's so tough. And yeah, and I've had days where you know, there was, a rash of stories about bullying, and you know, they were thinking, the coroner was exhuming the body of a child who, you know, had possibly been bullied, and I was going through my own experiences in school, you know, when I was in elementary school, thinking about that, and trying to come up with something, you know, to encapsulate that. And boy, you know, it was just, you know, some of those topics like that are just really tough to to boil down into a couple of words or an image. To me, when it's something easy, when it's something about politics or whatever, that's where, you'll see, cartoonists like us go to various visual tropes or whatever, but, it's those weightier topics that are kind of fuzzy around the edges. That's when it's really hard to just condense something down into a single image or a couple of lines of words.
Yeah. Joe, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I would agree. I think the heavier topics like bullying and mass shootings, mm-hmm. those are tough, and you have to be sensitive and delicate about that in order to get a point across.
Is there a particular cartoon that either one of you have done that you feel had really a really big impact on an issue?
Actually, I just recently did one, with the whole NFL kneeling situation, and I did my first cartoon for a syndicate, the Go Comics Syndicate, and it was the Statue of Liberty kneeling, and I mean it kind of went gangbusters, it went viral all over social media. But the one that really kind of stands out to me is when Officer Sonny Kim was killed, and I did a cartoon that day. Just very quickly got it up there. It was the Cincinnati police badge with a black band mm-hmm. around it, and it just said thank you. That cartoon was used on the side of the hearse. They turned it into a magnet, and it was on the side of his hearse during his funeral, and was on the programs for his funeral, and so that was quite impactful and very emotional just to me.
I think it goes back to your previous question. Those are heavy topics,
yeah.
And you nailed it with a simple but very poignant drawing, and I think that's what's key.
Is there a cartoon that you're particularly proud of, one that you say is my favorite cartoon that I ever did? Hmm. Or are they like your kids, you love every one of them?
I definitely don't love every one of them, but I will tell you one of my favorite situations with a cartoon. This was a couple of years ago where the streetcar had just been, the route had just been completed. They were getting everything set up, and there was another stop in the production of the streetcar, and I'd done this little tiny sketch of the streetcar route, and for those of you at home, I'm actually like tracing the streetcar route in the air with
he's
my
drawing
finger.
As we yeah. speak.
He's a true artist. He's got the visual thing going. Yeah.
And so I thought it'd be funny to do something where it was all the stops along the way. So not just the stops along the route, but it was the stops of starting construction, stopping construction, and all the delays and whatnot. And I thought that'd be funny for a cartoon. And this was the perfect time. And so I drew that cartoon up, and I published it on a Tuesday or Wednesday. And on Thursday, I just get a text message from Joe saying, "I'm so sorry." And well, so I know Joe's schedule, and he also draws on Tuesdays. We drew the same cartoon the same night, but his cartoon came out after mine.
yeah. So of course I see his, and I'm thinking, oh Lord, everybody's going to think that I'm just copying Kevin. But it really affirms what we know,
right.
Which is we think very similarly. We're looking at the same stuff, same thought processes, idea process, sketching. So it really affirmed that.
And actually, I mean, like that one instance actually got us thinking about we did our first talk about cartooning together. Based on that cartoon, because it's, to me, it was one of my favorite instances of of any kind of the quirkiness of cartooning life. Mm. But as Joe just said, we have to kind of look at the world in sort of the same way.
So now I find myself with an idea going, I hope Necessary doesn't come up with this one.
What's been your favorite cartoon?
lover or hater, Marge Schott, when she passed away, I drew a cartoon of her. Just kind of backing up a little bit. Everybody remembers the Reds mascot, her pet Shotzi,
right,
had passed away a few years before. And and so when Marge passed away, I drew her arriving at the pearly gates being greeted by Shotzi. And I don't know if it's necessarily my favorite cartoon, but it's one of those that people still talk about. You know, they just it's one of those that I think draws emotion, and so they remember it more.
What kind of reactions do you get to your work?
Lately, some hate. You know, I've been doing a lot of cartoons about the president, and our readership is I would say probably very conservative, and we hear it.
Yeah.
What about you? I think that's kind of indicative of our times, which is, when you like something, you just push a little button that just says like. Whereas if something is really getting your blood boiling, you're going to, you might spend, a good couple of minutes or hours, depending on who you are, writing something on Facebook or, trolling someone on social media. So, we hear the negative stuff, a little bit more loudly without necessarily knowing all the positive comments that we probably are getting
It's kind of that, if you go to a restaurant and you have a great experience, you tell two people. If you have a terrible experience, you tell 10. It's kind of goes into that.
Okay. So kind of off in a different direction here, which city council member makes for the best cartoon?
David Mann has always been my favorite to draw.
Same.
So you're both in agreement, David Mann.
Mm-hmm.
David, yeah. And he's
a great guy.
Yeah, he really is. But, oh boy, he's just so much fun.
That white hair.
Well, for somebody who wants to go into editorial cartooning, what advice would you have for him?
I'd say, draw. Draw every day. Read as much news as you possibly can. Listen to the radio, watch TV, and just become very informed. But, take all that information in and try to come up with, a cartoon a day. It doesn't have to be great. It just has to be something.
Yeah. It's a mental exercise and a physical exercise. I agree. Drawing, no matter what it is, draw.
And your 30 years of doing this, Joe, are you ever surprised by how much influence an editorial cartoon can have?
It still is amazing to me. It's how, especially with social media these days, how far they can go. And here, you get feedback from around the world. It's incredible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kevin, you feel the same way?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I'm still kind of surprised by some of the reactions that I get, even on a daily basis. To see how far a cartoon can go and to see what people can either read into it or take away from it, it's always just, it's fascinating to me.
I think that's the key too, is, we do this because we love it, but we want to make people think, and we want things to get better. And it's not just, because we're right.
We're right.
You're right. Yeah, we are.
Well, Joe and Kevin, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon. Cincinnati Business Courier editorial cartoonist and audience development director Joe Hoffecker, and illustrator and editorial cartoonist at WCPO.com, Kevin Necessary. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeier was the producer for today's show. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. The Cincinnati Human Relations Commission was established in 1943 as leaders in many cities were trying to defuse racial tensions in the country. On the next Cincinnati edition, we'll talk with the authors of a new history of the Human Relations Commission. We'll also hear how the city of Lancaster, Ohio, went from boom to bust. And we'll get a preview of the upcoming Books by the Banks Book Festival. That's Monday afternoon on Cincinnati Edition at 1 o'clock on 91.7 WVXU.